Case number 23-1029 et al. CP Anchorage Hotel 2 LLC, doing business as Gilton Anchorage, petitioner versus National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Baskin for the petitioner, Ms. Isbell for the respondent.
Good morning. Ms. Baskin on behalf of CP Anchorage Hotel, Hilton Anchorage, as we'll call it the hotel while we're talking today. In this case, the board found that the hotel violated duty to bargain, even though the decision to renovate hotel rooms was conceded by everyone not to be a bargainable decision. And even though, if treated as a effects case, the union never requested bargaining, despite being put on notice about
not what the board found. Board found quite the contrary. And remember, this is substantial evidence review, and the board recited the facts to support its conclusion that the union had requested bargaining. A case written by Judge Sentell in the past makes it clear that's not a heavy burden with respect to this kind of a fact. The findings clearly on the record.
Finding, but not supported by substantial evidence, Your Honor. And that's the issue.
If I think that the board's majority's recitation of the facts from the record are enough to support substantial evidence, that's the end of this, right?
If you find that on that one issue,
I'm starting where you started.
No, I started with the distinction between decision and effects bargaining. That the starting point is there was no decision that required bargaining.
Not questioning that.
Okay, well,
the board wrote an opinion that clearly accommodates the rules covering effects bargaining. And they said, and they made it clear, take this only as effects bargaining. The employer was deficient because the union didn't receive timely notice of the reservations, and the union clearly did request bargaining and was rebuffed.
But the board actually posed that as even if we did view it as the dissent viewed it as effects bargaining. And in fact, they said there is no difference. Their fundamental premise was that there's no difference between decision bargaining and effects bargaining.
In this case, it's fairly easy to see why they said that. They were essentially talking about a situation where no one, not the board majority or anyone else, is suggesting there was an obligation to bargain over the decision. No one is making that suggestion. And so the board is essentially looking at a case about what is the obligation with respect to on the employer when you've made a determination to go ahead and do this, what do you have to do? And the law is, as the board recited it, and it's fully supported, once you know you're going to make that decision, you have to give an indication to the union so that they have an opportunity to engage in at least effects bargaining.
Not when you make the decision. And that's the distinction between the decision bargaining and effects bargaining. If it's a bargaining over a decision, you have to talk to the union before you make the decision. And the board, so when the board said, and I quote, that the duty, the violation, and the remedy are the same, that represents, it indicates a fundamental misunderstanding that I know, Judge Edwards, that you are well aware of the distinctions that, you know, led to First National Mains. They should tell it to the Supreme Court if that is what their view of the law is, and it undercuts their entire analysis.
I think you'd like to get there, but I just don't see it in this record. I don't think the board's least bit confused over the reality that this is not a fight over the union has a right to bargain over a decision before it's made. That's not, in fact, the board recited saying once, I can't find the exact words now, once the employer knows that it's going to pursue this, they have an obligation to give the union some reasonable notice of the decision that's going to be made so the bargaining can pursue. Not over whether the decision should be made, but over the effects. The board understood exactly what this case is, the majority anyway.
We would have to disagree on what the board understood, because we believe that it fundamentally undercut their entire decision.
So what, if nobody is saying that the employer has to bargain over the renovations, what is the difference between framing this as a decision case where they're bargaining over the post-renovation decision about how the wages should be structured in light of the new walk-in showers on the one hand, or an effects case in which they're bargaining over all of the effects of the restructuring, which is going to be it's harder to clean the showers. Seems like you're either way, you're bargaining over the same set of issues.
Well, the big difference is that the employer in this case had no expectation that there was any effects, that there were any effects. And having put the union on notice repeatedly, starting in March of the year before it happened, they were not notified that there were any effects to discuss. Whereas in a decisional bargaining situation, the employer has an obligation to determine what impact there is. Once the decision is made and before implementation, the employer notified the union that this was coming and this was happening, and they give them the total specifications of the showers and all the rest.
Wouldn't the employer have a duty in either framing to go to the union to talk about wages, right? If it's a decision case, you can't unilaterally change the terms of the collective bargaining agreement. If it's an effects case, you have to give notice of the effects.
Yes, but when...
It seems practically very similar.
Well, but with fundamental differences that the courts, going back to First National Maintenance and Transmarine, it affects the discussion that is required, the elements of the decision versus simply the effects. I mean, that's what First National Maintenance was all about. If it was just the same thing, there were layoffs that occurred in First National Maintenance. That's the lead case on it. And if the board's attitude is true, then they would have been required to bargain about the decision to lay off. That is not what it was about.
That is absolutely not what the board majority said in this case. The board majority is so clear. It's really beyond dispute. The board majority is absolutely clear that we understand the only fight here is whether the union got adequate notice of what the employer was going to do within its rights so that it could discuss the effects of that. And the board found that they did not receive timely notice. They were put off and put off and put off until you got to the fall. And then finally, the employer said something. They didn't know the number. They didn't know precisely what was going to be done. They didn't know that there might be effect on the quota, work quota. None of that was revealed to the union. The union kept asking. And that's what the board majority said. They asked and asked and asked. They were rebuffed. Finally, they ultimately said, we want to bargain. When? That's so totally consistent with the established law.
No, it's not what the record reflects.
You're not doubting what I'm saying about the law, right? So the only question is whether the board was following that line of law, right?
Except that for this, where in your analysis, the board decided, and in difference from the administrative law judge, you didn't talk about it. The board decided that the employer must have made a decision to increase the workload of people. That is not what the employer did. The employer decided to renovate completely within its rights to do that with no discussion. The employer did not think there were any impacts. And so the employer made no decision to increase people's workloads or to affect the bonuses, which, by the way, the administrative law judge found there was no correlation in the end. There really was no impact. And so we have the lack of materiality and the lack of a significant change and the lack of knowledge or expectation by the employer that any of this was going to happen. And the union sandbagged it. That's all. They knew that it was coming. They never asked for bargaining. They just kept asking for information.
I don't know why.
They don't have that right.
I'm smiling because I just don't know what records you're reading.
Well,
that's not what the board said. You don't like what the board said.
Well, I'm going to the record.
They're entitled to review on a substantial evidence standard. And in my view, I'm only speaking for myself, this is so within substantial evidence, it's just not terribly interesting. The board clearly made the findings that the law required. You don't like those findings, but they clearly made the findings. And when you read Judge Sentell's opinion, I can't remember precisely which one it was, Stafco, whatever, this clearly was enough. clearly was enough for the board to survive a review here.
Appreciate your candor on the subject, but
You're entitled to have an argument before.
I would just submit.
Telling you, yes, that's the way I read the record.
Right. But the substantial evidence test requires there to be record to support these findings that the board made.
And if I find them, you lose.
And on that issue, yes, if you find substantial evidence in the record, but if you're looking in the right places, you won't see it. You'll see a characterization by the board of the record and saying that the employer didn't give them enough information. But what is, if the union is concerned about extra workload in a shower, then the first time they hear there's a wild shower coming, they know that there's an issue and they should ask for discussion. All right, if they don't know it then, that's in March, by the way, when they know that it's coming. But then they get the specifications, exact details, pictures, color pictures of all the room. There's a sign in the lobby that, you know, this wing is gonna be closed, we're gonna put showers in. How can they possibly contend that the union was not on sufficient notice to actually request bargaining about these so-called effects, not even to let the employer know that they think there are these so-called effects until finally in November they mention, and even then don't ask for bargaining. And by the way, when you talk about the record and did they request bargaining, I assume you read page 85 to 91 of the joint appendix, five full pages in which the company's lawyer asked the union vice president, did you ask for bargaining in March? Did you ask subsequently? And he candidly said, no, we did not do it. And so it wasn't a trick question.
Go ahead.
You're arguing sufficiency as to notice of the effects, right?
Correct. But also their failure to request the bargaining, two separate issues.
We're treated this as a decision case. So, and you contest that. I think you just assume you have a forfeiture problem with that. So we're thinking of this, assume we think of this as a decision bargaining case. Does any of that matter? If this is a decision bargaining case, they make the decision that the wages will stay the same, even in light of the restructuring, and they, regardless of any notice issue, they have an obligation to bargain over that before they implement that.
No.
You know, change wage structure or same wage structure in light of the changed reconfigured rooms.
Well, but it's a non-change here. You can't say that they have an obligation or duty to bargain about not making a change. And that seems to be what the union and the board, to some extent, is saying. Not the right way. It's the flip side.
So if we think of it as a decision case, your argument is there's no evidence of this second decision as to wages.
There's no evidence that there was a decision at all as to making any change in the wages or their work load, which the testimony from the employers consistent throughout that they felt it would be lesser of a load, no more bathtubs to clean. And the glass and the shower curtains are equal and other aspects of it.
But if we, as Judge Katz is suggesting, if we view the case, as bizarre as it might be, as a decisional bargaining case, a decision to increase duties, aren't the only two questions, did you give notice before that change decision was made? And two, was it a material change, right?
You would also have to include that the employer have an expectation that's what it was doing, you know, that it was in creating.
That's subsumed in the question of whether the change was material. And there's certainly, you have a substantial evidence challenge to these housekeepers' testimony, but they've testified and the board found that it was a material change in their duties in terms of how much work to get done in a day. So I think a version of the question is, if we find the effects bargaining framework forfeited, you're not making a notice argument under the decisional bargaining framework. Are you? You're just challenging the evidence of materiality.
Well, we're challenging the notion that this was a challengeable decision, a bargainable decision. And that's where this expectation thing you're indicating, I understand what you're saying about it being subsumed in the materiality question, but we would submit it is subsumed in the decisional question. What is the decision they're making? They can't be held to have made a decision if they had no understanding that it was an event, that there was any impact. So they can't be said to have made the decision without an expectation that it was going to increase job duties and or reduce pay, which again, continue to submit it. The evidence does not show that it did either of those things. I think I've run into my rebuttal time, but happy to continue or we'll come back.
We'll give you time if you need anything else.
No.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Hear from the board.
Good morning. May it please the court, Kelly Isbell here on behalf of the National Labor Relations Board. My colleague has framed this as an effects bargaining case, but that issue was not presented to the board below.
How could it be anything other than an effects bargaining case?
Well, the board found that it was a decisional bargaining case, right? So on the complaint—
There's an antecedent decision to renovate the hotel rooms. Everyone agrees that's, we don't have to bargain over that.
Yes, sir.
And the salaries, the 17 rooms in 8 hours rule, that's just in the collective bargaining agreement. That is what it is. There's no separate decision to change that. The point is the decision to reconfigure the rooms has an effect on the maid's jobs going forward.
I don't think on this record that there is any real question that the amount of work required of those employees increased substantially when the new showers went in. The quota stayed the same. The quota cannot be—
in the collective bargaining agreement, right?
Not exactly, Your Honor.
17 rooms in 8 hours, I thought it was.
It's in a last, best, and final contract that was implemented after impact.
Last, best, and final offer.
So right.
Allowed to implement.
There's no allegation that the implementation was—
impasse, they can implement that.
Correct. So it's not exactly a collectively bargained contract anymore. It's a unilateral imposition.
Right, but that's still the rule that they're operating under.
That's still the rule they're operating under with the bathtubs. Right. So the quota was imposed at a time when all of the rooms had bathtubs and it took a certain amount of time to clean these rooms. You could finish, you could do your 17 rooms and you might be able to do a couple more and get this bonus. Once the glass showers went in, that workload increased and the quota was no longer exactly tied to the amount of work.
Would you be making the same argument if 17 rooms, 8 hours was just a clear, bright line rule that had been stated in a collective bargaining agreement?
On these facts, I don't think so, Your Honor, because the amount of work increased. So an employer has to bargain, collective bargaining agreement or no, as long as there's a union, they have to bargain over any kind of increase in work duties. Additional work duties, changes in work duties. They have to bargain about that. The fact that 17...
Well, they have to bargain over decisions that affect terms and conditions, or they have to bargain over effects of business decisions.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's just, this seems much more like the latter.
So now we're talking in terms of the theory the board used.
I'm not sure why it matters, but it just... the case has a very artificial feel to me if we are forced to think of an effects case as a decision case. Your argument, but you know, what I keep coming back to in my mind is, you know, this is a Supreme Court case once that said you can't bind a court to apply a field. I mean, we're just thinking. We have to think about this case in a very artificial way. And I'm trying to...
Why does this matter to you?
In this particular...
it seems to me we're talking about something of no particular consequence when you're thinking about the obligation to bargain.
In this particular case, it does not matter. As the board explained, the duty and the violation of the remedy.
Everyone's conceding there's no duty to bargain over the decision to renovate. So that's off the table.
It's off the table.
So there are other things that we're talking about. The quota work and, you know, pay for the work you're doing and the consequences of the decision that the employer could make, all of which are normally within the realm of bargaining, at least as I understood it. That's no big deal. They're within the realm, however you characterize it. I was actually kind of amused. I guess I had forgotten. I didn't even know we were fondling the effects bargaining, of course, because that in some cases has a big consequence. I don't know why this matters here.
It doesn't matter in this particular case. There are cases where it matters.
Let me ask you, I largely agree with that, except maybe for the threat point.
Okay.
If you think that there was this second decision to keep the same quota, notwithstanding the increased work, then when they go to the employees and say, this is the rule, you darn well better follow it, that's a threat. If it's an effects case, that's just the pre-established rule over wages, and they're allowed to make the employees stick to a rule that hasn't changed while they're bargaining.
Help me out if I misunderstand, but I disagree.
Okay.
Even if it's
walk me through it.
Even though I don't understand it.
Right. Even if it's an effects case.
Right.
They have to bargain about the increased workload mm-hmm. and the quota.
Yeah.
They called these, I was going to say women, I these employees, into a room, mm-hmm. sit them down, make them sign this document under the threat of discipline. You must meet this quota or we're going to discipline you up to and including firing. They had never done that before. So no matter how long that quota had been in effect, they have never called these employees into a room and made them sign a document threatening them with discharge if they don't meet the quota. This threat came after the employees had told the employer, this is hard, it takes longer, and it hurts.
No, but what's important here in answer to my colleague is that they did this without ever discussing with the union the consequences that were going to flow from the decision. That is, the workload is going to change, and so what's in the collective bargaining agreement may look facially applicable, but it's not. There was a perfectly reasonable request the union could make to discuss that, because even though the contract written to deal with a different circumstance is there, the union's claim is it's not the same circumstance, and under established law, you have an obligation to discuss this with us, whether you call it effects or decisions. You have to discuss it to a point of impasse, right?
Yes. Short answer. Absolutely.
That's my recollection of the law. You have an obligation to discuss to impasse. You may lose it, but you have an obligation to discuss.
Yes.
Okay,
absolutely.
But what happens in the interim while they're discussing this and the housekeepers are cleaning the rooms?
You mean
how are they paid? Under what terms are they paid at that?
Well, literally in this case, I would have to think about that. If they were bargaining and then it might work itself out, right? I mean, the issue is some of the housekeepers asked not to, in terms of the money, the issue is some of the housekeepers asked not to have to do the showers because it was too hard, and those requests were granted. So other housekeepers had to do the showers, and the amount of money they would make would decrease, while the amount of money the ladies who got out of the obligation, they could get the... So without looking at a compliance document and figuring out who did which rooms when, I don't know that I can answer your question.
My colleague's asking what would happen. What would happen is what happens all the time. The employer would say, this is my position. And then the consequences will be depending on whether you go to arbitration, go to grievance and arbitration and fight it out and say they don't have support for what they're now requiring, or you come to the board and say they failed to discuss this with us to an impasse over this issue. That's what would have happened. The employer would keep going on. The employers are not, and threatening as well, and that's your position, is you can't threaten. You got to go through the effects, at least effects bargaining first before you start threatening anyone. But we're paying you under what we think the contract says. And then if the union wants to file a grievance, they can, or they can come to the board.
What he said.
Council, under effects bargaining, isn't the obligation to bargain before the effect takes effect?
You have to give pre-implementation notice and opportunity to bargain. Yes. Right.
So if the effects are already in place, if the housekeepers have already for months been cleaning these rooms, isn't that
there's
too
no
late?
Room. Well, not for
if
the.
If they had initiated the bargaining, is your point, and maybe they just hadn't reached a new agreement yet, it could be okay.
Well, in terms of the housekeepers' work, it's never too late. I mean, they're still doing this hard work under a higher quota with the effects on the amount of money they can earn and on injuries. Remember, one lady was hurt her shoulders by doing this work. So it's never too late. So I think I maybe didn't quite understand. Even though the decision has been made or the effects have gone into effect,
right,
they can bargain now. I mean, even after the union was asking for its information and requesting information about training, there was no training provided. That could happen still. The tools they were given to clean, the ladies didn't like those tools, so there's bargaining that happened about the kind of materials they're using to clean the showers. All of that could happen, Your Honor.
All right, so I have a different question about the effects versus decisional. Assume I agree with everything that's been suggested, that it's more natural to regard this as effects bargaining and that it doesn't make a difference to the outcome. But one thing it makes a difference to, isn't it, is what we're allowed to do as a court, right? Because we have these cases saying that 10E is a jurisdictional bar. So don't we, to have an opinion that affirms and enforces on an effects bargaining theory, don't we have to resolve the question of whether the company adequately preserved this in front of the board? In other words, we have to resolve your forfeiture argument, don't we?
To reach an effects bargaining decision, yes.
So at least that question is important in terms of the difference of these two analyses. And I guess I think Judge Mattis's question was suggesting that this is a sort of a more fundamental legal error than we typically find forfeited. Do you agree with that?
Well, I disagree. However, it might be easiest to conceive of the legal theories in this case. It was presented to the board as a decision. That's how the GC, the general counsel, pled the complaint. That's how the parties argued it below. There is no indication in the hotel's exceptions or its brief in support of exceptions indicating that it believed this was an effects bargaining case. And as I read their exceptions brief, they're arguing that it's a decisional case. It's how everyone understood it. In this particular case, it didn't really matter how the board decided the case because they have to bargain about the effect on the employees of that increased workload in the quota. The remedy was the same in this particular case.
I may be misrecalling something, but I thought something in the company's papers from ALJ to the board clearly was suggesting that the issue really should be viewed as a matter of effects. And that explained why the board covered the whole framework when the board majority covered the whole framework when it decided the case. The company clearly, in my view, I don't think there's any forfeiture of anything here. It wasn't entirely clear what the ALJ was saying, but I thought the company then said, no, they viewed the case slightly differently. And the board, in its decision, dealt with both.
Yeah.
Call it what you will, there's a failure of bargaining, is what the board said.
The only thing I see in their papers below that suggests effects bargaining is in the post-hearing brief to the administrative law judge. In their exceptions brief to the board, their argument is that the general counsel had to prove that holding the employees the same quota when cleaning the new rooms was a material change in terms and conditions of employment. They don't use the word effects bargaining in their exceptions brief. Only in the brief to the ALJ You have to raise it in your exceptions, your exceptions brief, or your reply in support. It somewhere in the papers you sent to the board.
I mean, they're arguing it in effect, so to speak. I don't know how it can be missed. The thrust of their argument includes claims about effects of bargaining. But you all have suddenly, you're landing on magical words, and I've never even seen these in play much in all my years. They just, except for effects bargaining, which is a clear category. But these categorical distinctions here and suggesting they're meaningful, I just don't get it.
In terms of when things are raised?
Yeah, I mean, the employer clearly was suggesting the focus ought to be about effects, along with its other objections to what the ALJ was suggesting. And the board's decision is broad enough to cover both.
Yes, to that last point. The board viewed what they raised in exceptions as not raising the effects bargaining argument. The board responded to Member Ring in his dissent. However, the board has given you a full-throated analysis of the effects bargaining theory in this case. So if you agree it was fully raised and there's no forfeiture, then you can affirm the board's decision based on the effects bargaining theory that the board provided. I see I'm out of time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brief. At the outset, General Counsel made an important concession. She conceded that this was decided by the board as a decisional bargaining case, notwithstanding our earlier dialogue about, you know, which one was it, and notwithstanding whether that makes a difference, although we think it does. And that is an important fact that we did raise below, and not only in saying, I mean, there was a bait and switch that went on. The complaint started off saying that you've somehow done something decision. But by the time it got, they amended the complaint, and by the time the case was tried, it was all about the effects. And the judge's decision kind of dodged the issue. And I think that's why the board felt they had to come up with a new rationale, which is a mistaken rationale. And when that happens, the courts have said to overcome any 10E concern, you should file, the employer should file a motion for reconsideration, which is exactly what we did. So we preserved the objection to treatment of this case as a decisional bargaining case. One important aspect of the distinction between decisional and effects bargaining is the Transmarine case dealing with the remedy, because the board here ordered a rescission, which is totally undoable. You can't rescind the renovations. The employer hasn't changed the bonus structure, so there's nothing to rescind there, other than telling the employees don't clean the showers, which is also obviously impracticable.
Going to the forfeiture question, is there something in the exceptions to the ALJ's decision or your brief that you would direct us to show that you were thinking of it as an effects bargaining case?
Well, particularly in the reply brief, that's pretty much, well, it is the highlighted focus of it, because that is what the ALJ was focused on. So
the reply in front of the ALJ?
No, the reply to the board. The reply in the exceptions brief to the board is all about discussion of the effects and the fact that it didn't have the impact, and that's really all there was to discuss the way the ALJ left it. So we would point you there. Would urge you to read again the testimony of the vice president, because vice president, they did not request bargaining. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Case is submitted.